Today in Studio 360, The Hunt is Afoot.
What's that?
With Sherlock Holmes back in movie theaters, the film's director, Guy Ritchie, helps out.
It's kind of a 19th century James Bond. There's something there to both titillate the spirit and the intellect.
We'll also hear how Holmes inspired one of the best current shows on television, House, a detective with an MD degree.
You're orange, you moron.
In the real world, a character like this would not be tolerated, although the world does tolerate genius.
Also on the case, Encyclopedia Brown.
He charges 25 cents a case, which is a little bit preposterous, but in 1961, 25 cents a case was adequate.
And later this hour, an original work of Christmas fiction by, well, me. I'm Kurt Anderson. That is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today we'll hear a holiday tale about a spy whose cover gets blown. He'd been observing us, all of us, for a long, long time. But first...
It's a game, dear man, a shadowy game. We're playing cat and mouse, the professor and I. Cloak and dagger.
I thought it was spider and fly.
I'm not a fly, I'm a cat.
Not a mouse, but a dagger.
This Hollywood movie glut weekend, I'll definitely buy a ticket to see Robert Downey Jr. returning as Sherlock Holmes with Jude Law as Watson.
You're drinking embalming fluid.
Yes. Care for a drop?
You do seem...
excited.
Manic.
I am.
Verging on...
ecstatic.
Psychotic. I should have brought you a sedative.
There's not much 19th century pop culture that still plays so well. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle introduced Sherlock Holmes in a Victorian magazine called Beaton's Christmas Annual in 1887. Since then, there have been hundreds of adaptations, plays, movies, radio dramas, TV shows, but Holmes isn't stuck in the past. WNYC's Sarah Montague looks at how the character keeps evolving with the times.
From an acting point of view, it's like a tightrope of a part.
David Stewart Davies is the author of several books about the screen career of Sherlock Holmes.
Murder?
There's no doubt about it in my mind. Or perhaps I should say in my imagination. But that's where crimes are conceived and where they're solved, in the imagination.
You have to do so much. You have to be cold and arrogant, but at the same time charismatic and likable. And it's a very difficult thing. Many, many great actors have tried playing Holmes and failed.
The stories were written carelessly, with many contradictory details. Nevertheless, Holmes turned out to be the Hamlet of detective fiction, a rite of passage. A proving ground.
Conan Doyle created an incomplete portrait of Holmes in his creation of the character. It's rather like one of those paintings by numbers, pictures with some of the segments left blank.
The first great theatrical Holmes was William Gillette, an American actor who premiered his play Sherlock Holmes in 1899. It was Gillette who introduced the iconic trappings most people associate with Holmes, the ubiquitous deerstalker, the curvy pipe and brocade dressing gown, and his naturalistic acting style gave Conan Doyle's acerbic Victorian gentleman a matinee idol appeal. But Holmes evolved with the times. And when Basil Rathbone stepped onto the moors in the 1939 Hound of the Baskervilles, it was with the keen fervor of a wartime champion.
For the British, he seemed wholly England, standing personified against whatever foe.
Sherlockian scholar Susan Rice.
He was sure of himself, and at a time of an enormous turmoil, isn't that what you seek? The sure hand to pull you up out of the abyss.
Make no mistake, Watson. This is not a duel of intellect with a cruel but single-minded Gestapo killer. This is our greatest problem. With England as the stake, and our antagonist, Professor Moriarty.
With the Nazis vanquished, Holmes receded to the realm of schoolboy classics, and the complacent 1950s couldn't quite pull him off the page. He revived in the restless decades that followed, and something had changed.
I think today what we celebrate in Sherlock Holmes is not so much the heroism. Instead, it's the determined outsider.
Leslie Klinger, author of The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes.
Holmes is a loner. Holmes bucks the system. Holmes is independent. He doesn't necessarily follow the law. He takes the law into his own hands.
And in the 1976 film The 7% Solution, he has an emblematic counterculture weakness. Here's Nicole Williamson's Holmes battling cocaine addiction with the help of Sigmund Freud.
Who am I that your friends should wish us to meet?
Beyond the fact that you are a brilliant Jewish physician who was born in Hungary and studied for a while in Paris, and that certain radical theories of yours have alienated the respectable medical community so that you have severed your connections with various hospitals and branches of the medical fraternity, beyond this I can deduce little.
Today we'd probably diagnose him as bipolar, vast mood swings, depending on whether he has a case in front of him.
As it happens, the next great Holmes was bipolar.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. But I abhor the dull routine of existence.
Jeremy Brett breathed new life into Holmes in 41 lush TV adaptations of the original Conan Doyle stories, beginning in 1984. Brett's own manic depression colored and sometimes undermined his performances, which swung from taut to grandiose, but gave him a unique perspective on a character he felt was as fragile as he was. Here's Brett in an 80s television interview.
I've always thought Holmes was a sort of damaged penguin or a kind of black beetle. I never thought he was heroic at all. Yeah. I wouldn't cross the road to meet him. And I find him an enormous strain to play. He is a very dark private man.
Tomorrow, at midday, the world as you know it will end.
Well, there isn't any time to waste then, is there?
Or not so dark and private.
It's kind of a 19th century James Bond.
In his pyrotechnic 2009 film, Sherlock Holmes, and its sequel, A Game of Shadows, director Guy Ritchie uses fast-paced contemporary film techniques to reflect Holmes' dual nature.
You should feel his antipathy toward being left with his own thoughts for too long. It's not a unique idea that geniuses are flawed. They're proportionate to the shine is proportionate to the shade.
And who better to embody shine and shade than Robert Downey Jr., whom Ritchie says was designed to play this role. He cites a dazzling, raging bull-like fight scene in Sherlock Holmes as an example of what he calls Downey's Holmeso vision.
Which is Robert's almost autistic ability to induce an enormous amount of information.
First, distract target. Then block his blind jab. Counter with cross to left cheek. Heel kick to diaphragm. In summary, ears ringing, jaw fractured, 3 ribs cracked, 4 broken. Physical recovery, 6 weeks. Full psychological recovery, 6 months. Capacity to spit it back of head, neutralized.
He's both esoteric and accessible. You know, he's a multidimensional character. There's something there to both titillate the spirit and the intellect.
Here dwell together still two men of note, who never lived and so can never die, wrote the poet Vincent Starrett in his 1942 sonnet, 221B Baker Street. And now, A Game of Shadows pits Holmes against his greatest adversary, Professor Moriarty, and gives Robert Downey Jr. another shot at Sherlockian immortality. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Montague.
Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, is in theaters now. This new movie is just the latest addition to a staggering amount of Holmesiana out there. The Fort Knox of all that material is at the Sherlock Holmes Archive, which is not, surprisingly, in London, but at the University of Minnesota. That is, under the University of Minnesota in its rare book collection. Sarah Lemanchik took the elevator down to see it.
So we're going down to the Holy of Holies.
Way down.
It seems only fitting that the world's largest Sherlock Holmes collection is kept in secret, buried some 9 stories below the earth.
So, yeah, we're 85 feet underground. You'll notice it's a little cooler down here.
Walking into the library's limestone caverns, I was hoping for echoing stone steps and flickering wall sconces. So I was a little unprepared for the Hitler's bunker feel of the place. Still,
here we are.
The locks were pretty cool.
This is Bay 6.
Tim Johnson is the curator of special collections and rare books at the University of Minnesota.
We've got the good, the bad, and the ugly here.
And really, he's not kidding. Original manuscript page from The Hound of the Baskervilles? Good.
Doyle had pretty clear handwriting for a doctor.
Then,
these are
the marionettes.
Covered up by Raggedy Ann and Andy that are also dressed up as Sherlock and Dr. Watson. Very dapper.
Yeah, but is there anything strange?
We've got bars of soap that are carved sculptures of Sherlock Holmes done by prisoners in prison.
Okay, that is strange. Standing knee-deep in matchboxes and tea towels, you can see how the character evolved, for better or worse.
We've also got the Sesame Street character, Sherlock Hemlock, as a needlepoint pillow, saying, "Egad."
Egad, the hunt's afoot. Show me the clues.
Why, who are you?
Sherlock Hemlock, the world's greatest detective.
OMG, my first brush with Holmes was the case of the missing chicken salad sandwich.
Whoever ate your sandwich doesn't like bread crust.
I mean, that's part of the icon. You've got the magnifying glass, the hat, the pipe. You see those three things, you know you're talking Sherlock.
But for the university, talk is cheap. They want action.
Yeah, one year they wanted me to get dressed up as Sherlock Holmes and be at the state fair and talk about the collection. I said, there's no way I'm going to stand out at the fairgrounds in 90-degree heat in a full woolen Inverness cape and a deerstalker hat.
Johnson wore the hat and shorts. 85 feet below Minnesota, I'm Sarah Lemanchik for Studio 360.
85 feet below Minnesota would be a good name for a band. I'm Kurt Anderson, and coming up, we'll hear how Holmes turned into House.
And the sign in the bathroom says that employees must wash after using the facilities, but I figure that somebody who wipes snot on a sleeve isn't hyper-concerned about sanitary conditions.
That's all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and today we're asking the question, what up, Holmes? You may not realize it, but Sherlock Holmes is all over primetime television. Law & Order, CSI, Cold Case, and probably the single character most indebted to Holmes isn't a detective at all. He's the diagnostic physician, Dr. Gregory House.
Differential diagnosis, people. If it's not a tumor, what are the suspects? Why couldn't she talk?
Aneurysm, stroke, or some other ischemic syndrome.
Get her a contrast MRI.
Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease?
Mad cow.
Mad zebra.
Wernicke's encephalopathy?
No. Blood thiamine level was normal.
Lab in Trenton could have screwed up the blood test. I assume it's a corollary of people lie that people screw up.
Redraw the blood tests and get her scheduled for that contrast MRI ASAP. Let's find out what kind of zebra we're treating here.
Dr. House is played by Hugh Laurie, and House's creator is David Shore, who's here with me today. When did viewers start making the Sherlock Holmes connection and saying, what's he doing here?
Good question. People have been trickling into that concept since day one. Instead of Holmes and Watson, we have House and Wilson. And he lives at 221, not Baker Street, but apartment B. And
there are so many.
Problem.
And the drug problem, and the arrogance, and the, you know, brilliant inductive reasoning, and the no serious romantic relationship, and so much more.
And the greater concern for the truth than for the humanity of the situation. You know, it was all about rationality to him. That was probably the biggest thing. That was the thing that I really wanted to do with the character. And as I was doing with the character, I realized I was sort of ripping off Arthur Conan Doyle. So I thought I'd give him a little credit.
And of course, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a physician.
And not only was he a physician, and this is a story that Hugh Laurie brought to my attention. While we were shooting the pilot, Hugh Laurie came to me and explained a story about that he had read about Joseph Bell. That Joseph Bell, who was a professor of Arthur Conan Doyle's in medical school, was in fact the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes. He was a doctor who would go around and look at a patient and deduce what was wrong with that patient and deduce things about that patient from little tiny clues concerning that patient, which of course is what we have House doing. So in fact, House is a doctor who was inspired by a detective who was inspired by a doctor.
Well, in fact, funny you should mention Dr. Bell. We have a recording here of Arthur Conan Doyle from 1930, recorded not long before he died, and I want to play it for you.
Oh, fantastic.
Reading some detective stories, I was struck by the fact that their results were obtained in nearly every case by chance. I thought I would try my hand at writing a story where the hero would treat crime as Dr. Bell treated disease, and where science would take the place of chance. The result was Sherlock Holmes, and I confess that result has surprised me very much.
I have never heard Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. That was fantastic.
Like Holmes, House is this remarkably good judge of character, even though he has a rotten bedside manner. I want to play a scene in which House meets a patient whose skin has this odd orangey color, even though the guy has come in complaining about back pain.
I was playing golf and my cleats got stuck. I mean, it hurt a little, but I kept playing. The next morning, I could barely stand up. Well, you're smiling, so I take it that means this isn't serious. What's that? What are you doing?
Painkillers.
Oh, for you, for your leg.
No, because they're yummy. You want one? Make your back feel better. Unfortunately, you have a deeper problem. Your wife is having an affair.
What?
You're orange, you moron. It's one thing for you not to notice, but if your wife hasn't picked up on the fact that her husband has changed colors, she's just not paying attention. By the way, do you consume just a ridiculous amount of carrots and megadose vitamins? Carrots turn you yellow, then niacin turns you red. Find some finger paint and do the math. And get a good lawyer.
You know, this is a guy coming in because he's got back pain, and House doesn't simply jump to the fact that he's turned orange and doesn't even simply jump to the fact that he's been consuming vitamins and carrots. He goes beyond that to the fact that the man's wife has been having an affair.
Yeah.
In the real world, a character like this would not be tolerated, although the world does tolerate genius. You know, if you are smart enough and get results that are good enough, people will put up with a lot.
And would that the world embraced rationality more than it in fact does.
Exactly. It's very, very true.
So much about House is like a police procedural more than any conventional doctor show we've ever seen.
Yes, he's very much a detective. And that was the original concept of the show to some extent, was a police procedural in a hospital, a CSI in a hospital where the germs are the suspects. And it's all about deductive reasoning and finding the clues and finding the answer, which to some extent is what doctors do, and certainly it's what this doctor does in the Department of Diagnostic Medicine. To begin with, I think there was this potential pitfall for the show of being too enamored of the science. Even though, as I said, it's all about rationality, it still is that. It is the character. It is that character that I think drives this show. It is not, which particular disease the person's dying of each week. Germs don't have motives. Half of what Sherlock Holmes figured out was why people did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would certainly figure out who did it and how they did it, but why they do things. It's a why done it, usually.
David Shore, thanks very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
David Shore is the creator of House, which is now in its eighth and apparently final season. Sherlock Holmes has been through almost every conceivable transformation. David Shore turned him into a curmudgeonly doctor. The BBC's new Sherlock has him in present-day London. And Donald J. Sobel turned him into a kid. Leroy Brown is a bookish fifth grader who runs a detective agency out of his parents' garage. You probably know him by his nickname, Encyclopedia. Sobel likes to call him Sherlock Holmes in sneakers. And Studio 360's Derek John went to pay this Sobel fellow a visit.
Looking for clues to the author Donald J. Sobel, I fished out my old dog-eared copy of Encyclopedia Brown and the Case of the Disgusting Sneakers, number 18 in the series. A neighborhood kid named Phoebe hires Encyclopedia to find out who swiped her sweaty, smelly sneakers. Idaville's annual Disgusting Sneaker Contest was just around the corner, and Phoebe had been a shoe-in until her funky footwear went missing.
I need to change my shirt very often. I can tell you, you sit there and you perspire until finally you stop bleeding blood, you start bleeding perspiration, and then you get your story. You know, it's just a question of working it out.
Sobel has been working it out for almost 50 years now. The case of the missing roller skates, the case of the knife and the watermelon, 250 mysteries and counting. And like our hero, the author seems to have a limitless capacity for random facts.
A lot of people told me when the first book came out that it wouldn't be popular. The name was putting off. Big word, encyclopedia. No kid is going to enjoy a book with a name like that, and no youngster's going to take it off the shelf.
Sure enough, 24 publishers rejected Encyclopedia Brown, Boy Detective. But in 1963, Random House picked it up, and an American original was born.
Mr. and Mrs. Brown had one child. They called him Leroy, and so did his teachers. Everyone else in Idaville called him Encyclopedia. He was like a complete library, walking around in sneakers. Old ladies who did crossword puzzles were always stopping him on the street to ask him questions.
Sherlock Holmes is the number one mystery detective. You don't compete with Sherlock Holmes.
And yet, Sobel couldn't help himself. He took to calling Encyclopedia Sherlock Holmes in sneakers. And of course, he had a Watson.
Well, Sally Kimball is the junior partner. And at that time, there was a television show emanating from England called The Avengers. And the woman, Diana Riggs, was a karate expert.
I'm interested in karate.
She handled the rough going. Of course, in this period of time, 1960, 61, it wasn't fashionable for a girl or woman to work up a sweat.
Encyclopedia isn't exactly a wuss, but Sally is definitely the brawn of the operation. Together, they foil the nefarious schemes of every bully in town. Think Revenge of the Nerds, but 20 years earlier.
The first problem I had with the book was how to make Encyclopedia Brown likable. Because I remember from my school days, the smartest kid in the class was a nice kid, but he didn't have close friends. People shied away from him. So I had to work at that, and I had to make him modest, and I had to make him upright. He doesn't charge a fortune. He charges 25 cents a case, which is a little bit preposterous, but in 1961, 25 cents a case was adequate. Now, it's funny.
Which raises an interesting point. Idaville, the all-American town with the annual Disgusting Sneaker Contest, remains virtually unchanged today. Same with the author, who still relishes his wisecracking kids and corny one-liners.
Bugs Meany was the leader of the Tigers, a gang of older boys who caused more trouble than itching powder in Friday's wash.
I don't know. Did that get by?
If Sobel hasn't changed his tune, it's maybe because he doesn't have to. Every year, there's a new generation of 10-year-olds browsing juvenile fiction, just waiting to discover the boy detective.
A kid really isn't interested in the author. And a kid doesn't go to cocktail parties and discuss children's books. Any kid doesn't want an author to solve the mysteries of the universe or how we're going to get rid of pollution. He wants or she wants a good story, and that's what they want.
Unlike Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys, Sobel's never had an army of ghostwriters to help him come up with a good story. But at age 85, he's barely lost a step. Even as an adult, I often found myself flipping to the back of the book to see how Encyclopedia solved the case yet again.
I like the character. He's part of the family, four kids, and he was the fifth kid in the family. He was the breadwinner. You know, where do you get a breadwinner 10 years old? You got to hang on to him.
For Studio 360, I'm Derek John.
Donald J. Sobel's latest book, Encyclopedia Brown and the Case of the Secret UFOs, number 26 in the series, is in bookstores now. Up next, it's the season to sit around the fire and read stories of spies from outer space.
I arrived just over 1,500 years ago. I'm 1,807 of your years, which is really ancient, even on my planet.
Where? What planet are you from?
We call it Vrishungul.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting the New York Philharmonic's New Year's Eve Gala on Saturday, December 31st at 8. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings. Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The illustrator Lou Beach came on the show a couple of weeks ago to talk about his latest project, a collection of lovely miniature stories called 420 Characters. And we decided to put a challenge to you. Send us your short story, no longer than 420 characters, and you'll be entered to win a signed illustration by Beach. We've gotten about 200 entries so far. You can read them all at studio360.org. If you haven't sent yours in yet, you've got until New Year's Eve. We'll pick our winner in January. Speaking of writing fiction, last year I contributed to an anthology called Stories, All New Tales, put together by the great fantasy writer Neil Gaiman. I was honored to be included among extraordinary writers like Walter Mosley and Joyce Carol Oates. The story I wrote is a holiday tale of sorts, and we commissioned a dramatic enactment of it. So find a comfy chair, sit back, enjoy a nice warm beverage while you listen to human intelligence.
He found it painful to lie, which was unfortunate for someone who had spent most of his life as a spy. In recent years, for fun, he had sometimes told strangers, children as well as their childlike parents, who he really was.
I'm a spy. I'm here on a long-term intelligence gathering operation, but it's super top secret, so, you know, if you don't mind, I'd really... That's all I can say about it.
In America in the 21st century, who was going to be anything but amused by a charming, well-groomed old gentleman making a fantastic remark or two?
I'm officially stationed thousands of miles away, but I've been on assignment in Chicago practically forever.
He had looked like an old man even when he was younger. He had grown a full beard to conceal the purple cross-hatching of surgical scars on his chin and upper neck. Now that he was genuinely elderly, it pleased him that appearance and reality had come into sync. He looked old, and by any standard, he was old. One less lie to live. As for his mission, He doubted that anyone at headquarters was any longer aware of him or his mission, if headquarters still existed. Television had made his job much easier. The internet had made it moot. Yet he had continued to adhere to the four main directives of the contingency plan, almost as articles of faith.
Remain at the last position reported to headquarters. Maintain all necessary discretion and secrecy. Continue to chronicle the people and their society to whatever extent possible. Await retrieval.
Retrieval is the closest English translation of the word in the orders, not rescue. He'd come to resent that since the crash. Had he gone native? Probably so. So here he was, living in a city 1,000 times larger than when he arrived, chronicling and waiting, chronicling and waiting, chronicling and still waiting. It was 3 years ago when he first saw the throb of purple light and shouted so loudly that his young downstairs neighbor called up to see if he was all right. According to the contingency plan instructions, a purple light on his remote beacon meant that sensors on the exterior of the station were exposed to sunlight. And he inferred the obvious. When a third of the polar cap melted in the summer of 2007, the top of his old station, the tubing and tanks, were no longer buried by dozens of feet of Arctic ice.
What's taking them so long to find it?
For each of the last three summers, he has waited for the news bulletins and resulting global hysteria. And although it felt vaguely insubordinate...
To whom?
Or even traitorous.
To what?
He was excited by the prospect of everyone on Earth all at once learning the truth. Nancy Zuckerman had always liked spending time outdoors. When she was 7, she could stick a live worm on a fishing hook and set up a tent herself. But it was the second Indiana Jones sequel, the summer she turned 8, that set her old-fashioned dream. At the end of the 20th century, adults patronized little Nancy, not because she was a girl, but because explorers no longer existed. Fortunately, she was a cheerful team player, as well as a cheerfully independent loner. She used to say,
"If I could be a superhero, I would be totally willing to be like a second-string member of X-Men or the Justice League."
And so science and her particular field suited her. Exploration geophysics, specializing in the Arctic. She hadn't minded spending the last year and a half in the Svalbard Islands, northernmost Norway. She was attached to a project team testing the feasibility of thickening the polar cap by pumping seawater onto the ice and letting it freeze. Good data had been collected. Techniques had been refined. It wasn't heroic exploration of the kind she'd imagined as a child, but as she approached 30, she'd made her peace with the realities of incremental science and the world as it was. Or so she had thought until a few weeks ago. She was 5 days into an excursion aboard the university's research vessel, the Dauntless, taking a group of undergraduates on a tour of the edge of the ice cap. Around 2 a.m. one July morning, unable to sleep, she'd gotten up and taken one of the motorboats out, alone, to cruise close to the ice, looking for polar bears to photograph. It was warm, 46 degrees. The sky almost cloudless and the sun high in the sky. The sea was calm. 30 yards from the ice at the mouth of a new inlet, she cut the motor and let herself drift along. Sitting in the bottom of the boat, watching. Camera at the ready. She was exploring. A half hour passed. Some terns flew past, but she saw no bears or seals. When she heard and felt the thud, she figured she'd struck a chunk of submerged ice. The boat rocked freely in the water, even though it was stuck more or less in place.
What the hell?
She started probing underwater with the tip of an oar blade, and a foot and a half beneath the surface found not ice, but what felt like pipe. A big pipe. She climbed over to the opposite side to probe some more and found another pipe running parallel.
Completely bizarre.
Kneeling, she started to use the oar as a push-pull, levering it against the underwater pipe on one side to propel the boat back, shoving and coasting toward the opening through which she must have drifted. But then the dinghy stopped moving, caught between the mysterious pipes. The underwater pipes came together at an angle, and she was wedged near the apex, stuck fast.
Oh, damn, damn, damn.
She was alarmed, a little frightened. If the boat was stuck, it was not clear when she would be found. She hadn't brought along a radio. But she was also exhilarated. She was exploring. And she had discovered something. Twelve days ago, his beacon had started alternating a chartreuse throb with each purple one. Chartreuse meant that someone had entered the station, and the station's mapping console would give any clever intruder the precise location of the remote beacon. He could easily enough drop the beacon in a dumpster, or heave it into the Chicago River. Instead, he has gotten all his documents and images in order, the entire chronicle. He has packed a suitcase and straightened up the apartment. He's been watching cable TV and surfing the web constantly, awaiting the astonished news bulletins. But he's surprised when the front door buzzer buzzes. He had expected helicopters and floodlights and grappling hooks and special ops troopers in black visors and hazmat suits, automatic weapons and gas canisters. He'd even practiced dropping to the floor and putting his hands over his head. He wonders if it's the UPS guy.
Yes?
Hi. I'm looking for someone who also lives at the Arctic at 86 degrees, 19 minutes, 27 seconds north.
She's alone, apparently unarmed, and very young. She extends her right hand.
Hi, I'm Nancy Zuckerman.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Walker.
I'm a scientific researcher stationed in the Arctic.
Really? But so am I. Come on in.
I'd love to, thank you.
This is so fortunate. For the two of us,
They sit.
Sit down.
And she begins explaining herself in a nervous rush.
In Longyearbyen with the university.
Way up at the edge of the ice cap.
Or and accidentally jimmied the entry system.
Figured it was maybe some NATO facility.
Peculiar materials and shapes and digital interfaces.
Including the big digital map with its one blinking light in the middle of North America.
87 degrees, 35 minutes.
And so I found this image, this little plastic image, which turns out that it's you. I showed it to a lady downstairs, and here I am.
She'd talked for 10 minutes, yet she hadn't asked him where he's from or what he's doing here. Which is fine by him. He's in no particular hurry.
This is beyond surreal. I mean, I feel like I am on drugs. I mean, this is incredible. This is a whole category of something I cannot even define. And that's how exciting this is.
Who have you told about the station?
Not a soul.
He knows about keeping secrets.
I want to be the one to reveal it. To tell the whole story. To be, you know, the discoverer. Like Columbus or Magellan or Galileo or Einstein. Oh, you... Do you know who those people are?
Yes, I do.
He likes this girl. He will give her the gift she wants.
You said you saw images at the station?
Yeah.
Projected on the monitors?
Dozens of pictures on those spheres. 3D, in color, of huts and houses and towns and farm animals with carts and soldiers and temples. It looked like from all over the world. Europe, Asia, Africa.
Yeah, I know. I took them.
A lot of those images looked really old, unbelievably old. Not the pictures, I mean, but the people and the buildings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you were taking photographs all over the world before photography was invented.
And moving pictures, too. Videos, well, more or less.
May I ask your age?
This station was established in 429 AD, CE, whatever.
She stares. Her skepticism races to catch up with her astonishment.
I arrived just over 1,500 years ago. I'm 1807 of your years, which is really ancient, even on my planet.
It had seemed impossible to Nancy, but in the weeks since she'd discovered the underwater station, it had also seemed like the only plausible explanation. She tries not to hyperventilate.
Where? What planet are you from?
We call it Vrishangul. About 62 light years away. It's close by, but in the scheme of things, but far enough, it turns out, that it made me expendable.
He had imagined this encounter hundreds of times. Thousands. Even rehearsed it.
You're wondering if I'm insane, I expect. Well, there have been moments over the years when I started wondering the very thing. Am I a pathetic, demented geezer? Lots of schizophrenics have delusions along this line.
He picks up a pair of nail scissors from the coffee table and jabs
no!
hard into the palm of his right hand. His blood is a kind of day-glow orange, and as it drips from his hand onto the table, it sizzles and burns the wood like acid.
There are other mortifications I could perform, but...
He really does not want to remove his eyes from their sockets, or show her that he has a bifurcated phosphorescent penis, and no anus at all.
I believe you. I totally believe you.
His government had established a system to directly monitor civilizations on the 116 inhabited planets feasible for Vrishangilians to reach. A reconnaissance probe was sent to the Earth's surface to photograph intelligent life forms. He had had extensive surgery to look human. His station was installed beneath the polar ice, and voila, he was on his own. He flew around the world in a small aircraft, taking pictures, making videos, scribbling notes. He had a weapon, a long wand, which temporarily paralyzed nearby creatures. He preferred to demonstrate his good intentions by giving away tokens, beads, and bits of gold. Once each century, a mothership would visit to resupply him and return home with a copy of his meticulous multimedia chronicle of another Earth century.
So your people, back on your planet, were only seeing your reports 100 years after the fact. And you wouldn't hear back from them for 100 years after that?
The speed of light is the speed of light.
At the end of his 800-year tour of duty, in the 13th century, he was to have been replaced by a younger agent. But no mothership arrived in 1229. No mothership ever showed up again.
But so, why are you here now? Why aren't you up in the Arctic?
My kind of town, Chicago is.
She doesn't get the joke.
An accident.
One winter, he was wrapping up his annual northern field survey, flying north, when he lost power and crash-landed in Lake Michigan. He managed to get most of his gold, as well as the paralyzer, video equipment, and the portable beacon. The aircraft sank.
Our orders were unequivocal. Just remain as close as possible to the last position and wait for... rescue.
So you were here before the Europeans?
When the French arrived, fortunately, they ignored the stories the Indians told about me.
And you did what? Hunted and gathered?
This tangent makes him dread that she will ask to use his bathroom. He has no toilet paper.
Well, I don't eat, as such. My body absorbs nutrients from the air.
They had talked for more than 2 hours, and Nicholas had awoken 2 hours before she arrived. On this hot planet, pouring the nutrients he needs, Nicholas sleeps nearly 20 hours a day, and he's getting drowsy.
We have so much to talk about, so much!
Yes, we do indeed. But if you don't mind, perhaps I can nap.
Thank you. This is so extraordinary. I can't... Words really don't...
She reaches over and touches his shoulder.
Thank you.
I'm pleased to. Extraordinarily pleased that it was you who made the discovery. I am very, very lucky.
You're lucky? I mean, I won the lottery to end all lotteries. It's literally Christmas in July.
Christmas in July.
Nancy is horrified. Has this all been a practical joke? A hoax? Is this a setup for some incredibly elaborate reality show?
My fatigue has ruined my manners. I am so sorry. See, there's another part of the story I wanted to tell you later, but... Look, now that I've upset you, that simply will not do.
He describes his aircraft. It was 26 feet long, with a large transparent canopy, a complicated antenna array jutting out from the nose, and landing rails instead of wheels.
So, when the people, you know, in the north, the Nordics and the Laps and the rest saw me flying, cruising at low altitudes through the midwinter skies 900 years ago, 1100 years ago, what do you suppose they thought they were seeing?
Oh my God.
A sleigh? Pulled by flying reindeer, driven by a large bearded man who had given them gifts?
Oh my God.
She's had 3 weeks to get used to the idea that she'd discovered an extraterrestrial base and that she might actually find an intelligent being from another planet. But this, meeting Santa Claus, is too shocking to process.
Nicholas! Oh my God!
When they asked where I lived, I saw no reason to conceal the truth. Beyond the mountains of Corvo Centauri, I told them, near the top of the world. Although I don't believe I ever said at the North Pole.
He sleeps, still sitting on the couch. His head tilted back, Nancy can see the thick network of scars under the beard. It's almost midnight when he wakes. He walks to the bedroom and returns with a black spherical device that reminds Nancy of a magic eight ball.
May I sit next to you? I've never figured out the way to hook this thing up to the television.
Holy Christ, they've got sound! I'm an idiot. Of course they have sound.
She sees aerial panoramas of Lakota Indians chasing a bison over a cliff in the sandhills. Junks and gondolas on the Tigris in Baghdad. China's Great Wall, half-built. She watches and listens to slightly furtive-looking shots inside a bustling Viking tavern in northern England. Men packing a piece of bronze statuary into a crate in 11th-century Benin. A mock sea battle at the Colosseum in Rome. A smiling toddler in Edo speaking Japanese directly to the camera. And finally, a tall beardless man delivering a speech in Chicago in the summer of 1858.
If one man says it does not mean a Negro, why not another say it does not mean some other man? If that declaration is not the truth, let us get the statute book in which we find it and tear it out.
Yep. Abraham Lincoln.
I can take you back up to the station, and you can see if the people on Free Hunger. Right. Has sent any messages to you there for the last 700 years?
He shakes his head. If he could cry, he might cry.
Well, if I have your permission to tell your story to the world, I mean, if you prefer that I wait until after after you're gone to reveal everything posthumously, I would completely understand.
And when someone else stumbles across the station in the meantime? I'm so tired of keeping my secret.
He'd thought about saying, "All right, Miss Zuckerman, I'm ready for my close-up." But figured she probably wouldn't get it.
I thought I was going to have to persuade you.
I've had more than enough time to consider this, my dear.
He will hand over his chronicle, all 2.4 million words he's written, and all 73,496 hours of video he's shot on every continent but Antarctica, in every year from the early 5th century to the late 19th century. He will tell everything he knows about life in our part of the Milky Way, corroborated by the library of text and images stored at the station.
It's all badly out of date, of course, but it's better than nothing.
And he will give to the people of Earth his surviving pieces of technology, In particular, the batteries that power the video player and portable beacon and Arctic station, all still operating after a millennium.
I should think that some bright scientist somewhere will be able to reverse engineer them.
This is going to be unbelievable, Nicholas.
Well, let's hope not.
I mean, this will be the biggest thing ever.
I do hope that people, anyway, most people will be glad to learn that they're not alone in the universe.
Nicholas.
Yes?
May I hug you?
That was a story I wrote called Human Intelligence. The radio version was produced by Jonathan Mitchell. Melanie Hoops read the part of Nancy, and Nick was played by John Ottavino. The narrator was Ed Herbstman. You can read the unabridged version in the anthology Stories, All New Tales, edited by Neil Gaiman and Al Sarantonio, and now out in paperback. That does it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening. And from all of us at Studio 360, happy holidays. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogeson,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
And thanks this week and every week to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we sail in search of the great white whale.
He rises!
It's been seen as the story of a fascist, the story of a totalitarian communist, and most recently, the story of a terrorist.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me as we chase Moby Dick. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.